How can we provide the conditions under which the economy can continue to grow, under which people can continue to have higher levels of welfare? These are the things that really motivate this entire topic.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. And last week, we spoke to Lucy Gardin about how income and consumption taxes don't always work as intended when taxes are hard to collect or easy to evade. But turn to another page in the same issue of the Journal of Economic Perspectives, and we find a paper on the innovative or experimental ways that low-income countries are using to collect more tax. One of the authors is my guest today, Oyebola Okonobi of the World Bank. Welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you so much, Tim. It's great to be here.
How much smaller is the tax to GDP ratio in low-income countries compared to high-income countries?
Quite significantly smaller. So for example, in 2019, low-income countries collected about 12% on average of their GDP as taxes. Mm-hmm. And high-income countries, these was about 30%. And in between, you know, you have the lower middle-income countries that did about 18%, and then the upper middle-income countries with about 21%. So you definitely see this gradient that richer countries are able to collect a larger share of GDP in taxes.
Has this always been true?
There's always been this gap. But I think what's really interesting to note is that the higher income countries today, they have also grown over time. So if you look mm-hmm. at a century ago, in like 1920, the high income countries of today, they were collecting about 12% as well of their GDP as income. And so it's not that they've always been at this level, but over time, they have also increased their ability to collect taxes.
So can we conclude from that, that this problem of low tax capacity, it sort of solves itself as countries get richer? Or is it the case that governments are going to have to invest to improve their rate of tax collection?
There is that suggestion that perhaps this does go away by itself. But no, we do not see that in the data. We look at the last 30 years of data that we have. So we examine the relationship between the GDP growth in countries and their growth in tax collection. And this relationship is essentially flat. Countries are growing. The rate of growth is not correlated in any significant way with their rate of increase in their tax collection. I was looking at some work from Indonesia recently. They were collected much higher a decade ago. And now those numbers have gone down. And so many things happen country by country where you have periods of increases and then other times it comes down. And so what we are arguing in this paper is really that countries need to invest very intentionally. If you want to collect more taxes, there's specific dimensions of tax capacity that you need to grow in to be able to do so.
So where do they need to invest? What are the tasks of a tax system that they can improve?
Let's start from the very basics. One, you need to know who your taxpayers are. Mm-hmm. And we refer to this in the paper as identification. And this may sound like, why is that even a thing for tax collection? Doesn't everybody have a social security number that the governments can identify them? But actually, in many of these lower income countries, that is the starting point because there is no identification system. Next, we have to think about how much is the tax that really should be collected. And in this paper, we refer to that as detection capacity. It means that you have to be able to verify the true amount. Many tax systems ask people to self-declare, but the government then on the back end has to verify whatever the person has declared. Take the very basic case of an income tax of an individual. I can report that I was paid $20 by my employer, but many times, like in the US, for example, the employer sent a W-2 to also report I paid Oyebola $20. And once that matches, the government knows, okay, that's a third party report that has verified this transaction. And so that's really where a lot of countries need to turn to think carefully about what types of data can we collect from other parties to be able to verify the amounts that people are reporting so that we can know what the true liabilities are. And then after you've detected the liabilities, you then need to do the third step, which is to collect these liabilities. And this is also very, very important in low-income countries because you get a lot of evidence, for example, things like the property tax, where it's identified. Imagine they have a cadastre, they have property values that they've been able to detect, but then they just don't get collected for several years. And often this is because collection often involves enforcement. Mm-hmm. You know, taking people to court, adding penalties and interest, pretty much bringing the weight of the law to enforce these taxes. And we find that often that's where collection then doesn't happen. The other element of collection that we discuss is just simply making it easier for people to pay taxes.
Yeah.
Facilitating the tax payments. Don't have people go line up in a tax office and stamp their forms to be able to pay. Don't let them have to take a trip to the bank in the afternoon. If they can do all this electronically, that's probably good for them.
Your paper goes into the contribution that technology and officials and politics in the end can make to achieving all of these goals. And so, first of all, as you brought up, many people don't have a government issued ID, but policymakers would like to collect tax from them. Does that mean that we have to solve that ID problem first before the tax take goes up? Because that's a huge task.
Ultimately, countries need to address this problem. In the interim, there's some stopgap measures that countries are using. For instance, instead of waiting for a national ID, many tax administrations have their own tax ID that they issue to taxpayers. So that's a way for them at least to be able to recognize certain taxpayers. But what you find is that way they can only recognize a very small subset of the population because they can only see the people that are in the tax net.
Yeah.
So it's a stopgap measure, but it's not going to be ultimately sustainable. And so you're completely right that it is a very expensive effort. And so many times what I find is that countries have to wait for the government as a whole to do this. So the tax administration on its own cannot undertake this type of investment. But, you know, in many countries now, Ghana, Nigeria, you're starting to see a nationwide ID that governments are rolling out. And so then tax authorities can come on top of that to then leverage that for their own purposes. It's a similar thing with properties, for example. So you find that the stopgap measure that many tax authorities use is just the GPS coordinates. And so once you can capture that, you can go back to that property. You've identified it in your database. But in the long run, for things like infrastructure, like water and electricity, for the postal system, all these other government services that are provided, you need addresses for properties, which are missing in many African countries, even cities. And so when those are now in place, tax authorities can now leverage that to update their cadastre and update all of their tax systems so that they can be working from the same common framework as the rest of the government.
But say they do this and we identify the properties and we identify the people and then the government can inform them, we think you owe us some tax. Is that enough to move the needle?
It's an essential first step, but it's not enough. So I would say it's a necessary but not sufficient condition. We see a lot of examples of this. Governments go out and they try to register taxpayers and they bring them into the tax roll, but you don't get any revenue boosts automatically from that. I have some work that I've done in Liberia, for example, where I worked with the revenue authority to digitize their records on properties. So it was a door-to-door campaign in one part of the capital city that for the first time they were able to get locations of properties, photos of properties, the ownership information, and then use that information to send out notices to taxpayers. And the control group, you know, they just got a very generic notice. Please pay your taxes. This is the procedure to pay. Mm-hmm. And then there was an identification arm where their name was on the notice and the photo of their property was on the notice. So this was the state now using its new identification capacity to communicate to taxpayers that, Tim Phillips, we know that you own this property on this location.
Literally, we know where you live. Yeah,
exactly. And you owe taxes you've not been paying. So please come pay. And what we find is that that notice in itself does not move the needle. There's some kind of initial curiosity. We have an outcome and whether people respond to that notice. They do come, but we don't see any impact on payment. The notice that is able to achieve a higher payment rate is one that also includes what the penalties for non-compliance are. It lets them know what the legal provisions are for people who do not pay their taxes. And that's when we see the payment rates go up from about 2% of people in the control group to almost 10% in this treatment group. So it's a fivefold increase. And all of that to say that the identification in itself did not move the needle. It was the combination of both that was able to achieve this increase.
So when we come to detection, as we were discussing with Lucy, there is such a large informal sector in many low-income countries. So is it even possible to work out how much people owe or to find which people are evading tax?
Yeah, no, the large informal sector definitely has put some constraints on how far some of the government initiatives to detect liabilities are. So for instance, one of the things that a lot of governments do is to introduce what we call electronic fiscal devices. And these are machines that they put at the checkout counter such that as soon as you're paying and they're printing out a receipt for you, that transaction is immediately reported to the tax authority. And so they have that record of that transaction. And by extension, all of your sales, if you do use it. What we find is that this can only work among the people that the tax authority knows already. And so in that case, a large informal sector that's not registered, you wouldn't be able to benefit from this. But there are other technologies, for example, something like electronic invoicing, where people report who they're selling to and who they're buying from for VAT purposes. And they record these transactions. I've seen some cases where this actually is able to provide information on the informal sector, because if I am formal and I'm reporting, but then I have bought or sold with you, Tim, then the tax authority now has information that there is a seller or a buyer called Tim who is engaging in these transactions. I was just looking at a dissertation by Leo Sajak, who's defending any day from now. And this is exactly what his paper is looking at in Senegal that I found very interesting. Using formal firms to provide information on informal firms is one of the ways that we can find this in operation. Another way is using things like electronic payments. So I might be an informal firm where I'm not registered with the tax authority, but I'm using a bank account. I am using debit cards and credit cards, mobile money. These all create a trail of my revenues. And this is an example of third-party information that government might be able to use and leverage in knowing that I exist and also knowing that what my level of income and revenues are.
So we might expect, because you expect, as you've already said, in the US to have third-party data reported on you, and I would expect that in the UK. If this third-party data exists in these contexts, is it always going to make a difference? When might it work and not work?
So that's one really important thing to note, is that it's not enough to have this third-party information. I mean, we have quite a lot of evidence now on how useful third-party information can be, but this is when it's actually used. What you have many times in lower-income countries is that they don't actually use this in a very systematic way to detect evasion. So one example is from Uganda, where the tax authority did have all this data on buyers and sellers and the VAT and who was paying what to what. And the goal of this type of information is that you can cross-check, is the buyer reporting the same amount as the seller? And what they found was that 79% of observations, they had different amounts. What the seller said was different from what the buyer said. The goal of this data is that you look at all these people and you query them. You say, okay, what's going on? Why are you all reporting different things? And you use this type of data to guide your audits to the most risky firms and to think about what sectors might there be more evasion going on in. But often you find that this simply does not happen. And I think usually it's because of limited skills, limited IT, you know, data analytics skills. It's a lot of analytical power that goes into analyzing this, because it's millions and millions of observations that people have to work through. And so the good thing is that there are a lot of tools that are now available. We have a lot of machine learning tools that can help in doing this type of analysis, but there's not available training and skills that have been developed by people in tax authorities. And so that's a major role, is to think carefully about the tax officials and how they can leverage the technology and all the data that's now becoming available.
I'm going to discuss more about the role of tax officials with you in a second. But one more thing on technology before we do that. Digital technology makes it easier to pay your tax. If you decided you're going to pay your tax, it makes it easier to collect tax if that's what your job is. does using that technology, that, I mean, that technology is not pervasive everywhere and for everyone. Does it widen an inequality between haves and have-nots, people who live in rural and urban settings, for example, or people who are well-off and people who are not so well-off?
That's a major concern. People who generally have more difficulty using the internet could be disadvantaged. We have evidence from a variety of settings about female taxpayers, rural taxpayers, less educated taxpayers. These are some of the groups that have been identified as being less likely to adopt these e-services. So if you have a setting where the government makes it compulsory, this means that they all of a sudden face higher compliance costs. They have to find and pay someone to help them, and this could really disadvantage them. What we've seen in some settings is that having a lot of taxpayer education, for instance, in Tajikistan, there were these windows, they call them taxpayer help windows, that were open to help people to access electronic tax filing, electronic payments, give them a hand and help them free of charge by the tax authority. Other places like Rwanda, we've seen them introduce lower tech options. So instead of having to use the internet, you could file and pay using USSD, so non-smartphones. And so those are some ways we've seen governments responding to try to bridge this gap that technology could definitely lead to.
Great ideas. Okay, so let's talk about these tax officials. In low-income settings, what do the tax officials, what are their jobs? What do they do?
So I'd say that in many lower-income countries, tax officials are still very much on the front lines. They are still like boots on the ground. They're doing a lot of legwork on the streets, meeting the taxpayers, identifying them, spending time around their stores to observe the flow of customers, estimate what their revenues might be, all this in trying to do this work of identification and detection. I always make the joke that in my close to two decades in the United States and engaging with the tax system, I have never met a tax official. But ask any business owner or anyone that's really engaged in the tax system in many lower income countries, they have someone in the tax office that is their person that they go to with questions, that they deal with a lot. So look at things like the World Bank Enterprise Surveys about the number of meetings people have with tax officials. This is significantly higher in lower income countries. And so the work that tax officials do does still tend to be very manual, very heavy on customer interactions.
I mean, it sounds like that could be quite a hard job as well. Are there enough tax officials to do this? Would employing more make a difference?
It does not seem that there are enough of them, is what I would say.
Yeah.
We can look at just cross-country data and compare what this looks like across different countries. So there's the International Survey on Revenue Administration, and we see that in the United Kingdom, for example, the ratio of tax official to taxpayers is one official to about 1,000 taxpayers. You move to a place like Ghana and it's 10 times the amount.
Wow.
So one tax official to about 10,000 taxpayers. And so you see this very pronounced relationship across countries of different income levels, just suggesting that there's just not enough tax officials to collect these taxes. But it's not only the number, but you can also think of what are they doing? The tasks that they perform are quite different. In higher income country, you find that there's a higher share of officials that are assigned to things like audits and investigation compared to lower income country. And so there's more people who are sitting with the data trying to understand where to target the audit, the type of investigations to perform, and going after people who are high risk and who are not paying. And this goes back, I believe, to the point I was making earlier about the training and moving from the one-on-one engagement to a higher system level thinking with data analytics. Like, what are the broad trends we're seeing? What are the industries that seem to be at risk? How can we redirect our audits and our efforts in general to be able to maximize our tax collection?
With a ratio of 1 to 10,000, and if you join a queue because you need some advice or some help, you might wait a very long time in that queue. I guess one of the things that technology can do is to shorten that queue. But as you say, it also means that perhaps countries need a different type of tax official with a different type of education and different skills as well.
Absolutely. I think that that's really important. The selection of tax officials and this training, because they're obviously a large stock of tax officials already employed. Mm. The offices that I've worked with, you find that there is like an IT department or there are very few people who have data analytical skills. And what you need instead is for there to be any tax official who can access the data. If I'm the one going to audit a specific firm, there should be certain kinds of analysis that I must be able to run on my own and be able to target my audits effectively or be able to access different data sources on that taxpayer to get a much clearer picture using third-party information. So I think that really helping investing in training of tax officials, it's an important action by tax authorities.
One thing that we've discussed several times on Vox Dev Talks in the past has been the role of government employees. Would incentivizing tax officials to collect more tax, is that going to help? And also, is that going to help reduce corruption, which we know exists in every tax regime?
No, I think that the question of incentives, it's really a double-edged sword. Because on the one hand, we've seen evidence that it can increase the amount of efforts that tax officials put into their work. But on the other hand, we see, for instance, in a case by Khan Khwajan Olkhan in Pakistan, where they give monetary incentives to tax collectors. Yes, the revenues go up, but so do the bribes. Mm-hmm. What they argue is that this increases the bargaining power of the tax officials. And so they're actually able to extract more bribes. And that's not what we want. They, in the same setting, have another example of a different type of incentive that's non-monetary. So this was incentivizing tax officials by giving them higher preference for where their next posting would be. So the more you collect, the more you're able to determine your next posting. And there we have the same positive effect of increasing the revenues without the downside of increasing bribes. And so I think that for tax authorities to think very carefully about the types of incentives that they're putting in, that's really important.
While we're discussing governments, we always assume that governments want to collect as much tax as possible to maximize their revenues. Is this always true?
No. One of the most important things is to understand the motivation of governments to collect revenues. The main goal of most governments is to be reelected, is not to collect revenues. They're interested in collecting revenues to the extent that it helps them to be reelected. If I'm able to collect revenues and provide public goods, and that makes people happy and they're more likely to vote for me, that's one possible channel that might incentivize me to want to collect more revenues. But if there are other ways in which I'm able to access revenues, for instance, if I'm sitting on a lot of natural resources, then I may not actually be very incentivized to want to collect taxes. Once you even ask people to pay taxes, there's evidence that that increases the level of accountability that they're going to be expecting from you and the level of engagement. If a government is not really interested in having politically engaged citizens, then maybe I don't really want to collect taxes. I want to collect only as little as possible. Some of the things we identify as being factors that influence their likelihood of collecting is alternative revenue sources. We can also think about political competition. If there's cross-country evidence that shows that when there's a competitive election coming up, governments actually reduce the amount of taxes that are collected. Also, what technologies are available to governments to be able to collect these taxes in a way that's less salient and that reduces this cost? Because if it's a tax that's in people's faces, they may be more resistant. But if it's something like the VAT where they just pay to the store and it's quietly collected, sometimes governments are more likely to embrace that.
Clearly, you have wide experience, not just of the initiatives, the innovations that many countries are making now, but how they work when they're put into practice and maybe some of the unintended consequences of them. From what you have seen, which innovations do you think have the most potential when we're applying them in many countries or particular contexts?
I think that one of the things that we've seen across a large variety of contexts to deliver decent amounts of revenues when introduced in the range of like 50% increases in revenues have been this third-party information.
Yeah.
In a very wide range of countries, we've seen this effect. When you have the third-party information and you use it, you will tend to see these increases in tax collection. But there are other areas where we don't have as many studies, but what we do have is very promising. So going back to the issue of tax officials, papers that show us that when they're appropriately incentivized and deployed, we have seen things in the range of 150 to 200% increases in tax revenues. And all of this, actually, I should mention, we look at the evidence across papers where there's been positive impacts on revenue collection from these different innovations, like the deployment of tax officials, the use of technology for identification, detection, enforcement, identification, detection, collection, as well as the use of legal enforcement. 39 interventions from 26 countries is what I'm trying to summarize now.
Mm-hmm.
So I had mentioned what we found about third-party information and also this role of tax officials. The third one, which again, we don't have as much on, but it's the use of enforcement, the imposition of sanctions on people who do not comply. And there again, we've seen things as high as about 200% increase in tax revenues. And this, I think, ultimately is one of the things that we cannot get away from. So you could innovate a lot and take all the innovations and technology and use them to get all the best data and have all the most fancy machine learning algorithms and tools. But at the end of the day, whatever it says in the law as the penalties, you need to have court systems that work. You need to have ways of imposing that on citizens, because taxation, when you think about it, it's the coercion of resources from private citizens to the government.
Yep.
It's not a donation, it's a coercion. And so all of these tools are great, but at the end of the day, there needs to be a way to enforce.
Now, where we started with this was your observation that as economies are developing in the last 20, 30 years, they are not necessarily broadening their tax base, increasing their tax revenues without investment and without intention. From the evidence that you're seeing at the moment, are you optimistic or pessimistic that low-income countries today, as their economies develop, will be able to achieve that?
I am cautiously optimistic. Optimistic because there are a lot of tools that are now available that 100 years ago, today's high-income countries did not even have. With many areas of development, there's the opportunity to leapfrog to the frontier of these tools that could make the process of tax collection easier. There's a recognition of the importance of tax revenues, natural resources, very volatile, aid, not very reliable. The conversation is definitely shifting to the direction of countries wanting to collect more taxes. And many of the times you see this evidence coming from subnational entities, so local government or state government. You know, in the paper we talk about Lagos State, how they were able to triple revenues in a few years when the conditions were ripe for that. Tax collection is not a goal in and of itself. The whole purpose is the public services and the investment in human capital and infrastructure that taxes can achieve. How can we provide the conditions under which the economy can continue to grow, under which people can continue to have higher levels of welfare, where children are going to good schools, they're actually learning in those schools, where parents will have decent jobs and opportunities to provide for their families, where people can drive on good roads and not die in accidents. These are the things that really motivate this entire topic. Having visionary governments that seek to provide this type of life for citizens, the more likely that we'll be able to see these revenues translate into growth and to development and to increased welfare.
Oyebola, thank you.
Thank you so much, Tim.
Oyebola's paper, published jointly with Gabriel Turek, is called How Can Lower Income Countries Collect More Taxes? The Role of Technology, Tax Agents and Politics. Journal of Economic Perspectives, Volume 38, Number 1. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode, subscribe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. And all our past episodes, as ever, at voxdev.org, where you will also find articles about the subjects we feature.